Okay, so test in a week. Typical sort of test. There's an old version online. There are videos with the solutions of those tests. The 10-point questions, you said, are a pretty good idea what they're going to be, because I've said that probably this guy, the winner hexagon, something about stellar evolution, and remember that set of absolute magnitude, spectral type, which stars the hotter questions. It's another good guy. So the exam will cover through chapter 19, which we'll be talking about this week. It's our galaxy. My guess is that you don't feel like scheduling a help session today, but that's something to think about as we get closer. Any questions? So we've been talking mostly about stellar evolution, that is to say, how stars change with time. And last time we talked about end states of stars, that is to say, how can a star stop being subject to the Virial theorem, where it always gets hotter and can't cool off. And the kind of main story was that so if we looked at the low mass stars, none of them have really died yet. It looks like they have very low mass, so they don't have much fuel, but they're using it so frugally that they're going to last for a very, very long time. None of them have died yet. They will eventually cook themselves pretty calmly, because they're totally convective, into helium white dwarfs. The sun goes through all of these complicated stages that you need to be able to explain both on an HR diagram and in terms of what's happening at the core and what's happening in cross-section. But they spend most of their time burning hydrogen to helium in their core. They run out of core hydrogen. They start burning hydrogen to helium in a shell. They go up to become a red giant. The core is getting hotter and hotter and hotter. Eventually, it is hot enough to ignite helium burning to carbon. That happens when the star is degenerate, which means that the protections of the Virial theorem against explosion don't apply. So we have an explosion inside the star, helium flash. It's a totally enclosed explosion. Nothing much is visible from the outside. Star now has two sources of nuclear energy. It's got a shell of hydrogen burning to helium and a core of helium burning to carbon, but it actually becomes less luminous. So its surface becomes a little bit hotter, a lot smaller. Net result is less luminous, the horizontal branch. Repetition of the same story. Runs out of helium in its core. So it starts to have a shell of carbon, of helium burning to carbon, an inert carbon core, outer shell of hydrogen burning to helium. So it goes up the red giant branch again to an asymptotic giant stage. At that point, it undergoes thermal oscillations, puffs off its outer layers of its atmosphere. And what we see then is the core of the star, which will become a white dwarf, illuminating all of this gas that's been puffed off. That's the planetary nebula stage. And then the white dwarf just cools off as a very small, that is to say about the size of the Earth, object that starts out extremely hot, maybe 100,000 degrees surface temperature, and is gradually going to cool off. The more massive stars have, first of all, the most massive stars can avoid the Virial theorem entirely, right? Never become degenerate, burn everything to everything, end up with an iron core. And those are the guys that supernova. And the sort of supernova that we get is called a type 2 supernova. And we have seen historically these things occurring, not recently, I have to be a little bit careful. In our galaxy, not recently. We see them in other galaxies. Last one was during the time of Galileo. And we see the remnant that left behind, not uncommonly, will have a pulsar in it. Pulsar is a rotating neutron star. We have good reasons. We see some supernova remnants where there is nothing that we can see left behind. We think those are probably black holes left behind. And whatever is left behind seems to have a mass that's small compared to the original mass of the star. So a huge amount of material is ejected, and that's processed material, not just the hydrogen and helium left over from the Big Bang, but carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, everything up to iron, and in fact beyond iron, because the explosive process actually produces, uses up some energy to make some of those more massive nuclei. So the thing we mostly talked about, this was, I think, pretty much the previous time, the thing we more talked about was black holes. So let me comment that this is in the internal section S3, which I haven't assigned for reading, but if you're interested in learning more about that, you can read that. So black holes are a consequence of Einstein's general theory of relativity, which despite its name is a successor theory to Newton's theory of gravity. So it's a more exact version of Newtonian gravity. And it's now 100 years old, and really only in the last 20, 30 years has it been, in the solar system, it deviates from Newton's laws by extremely small amounts. So really only in the last 20, 30 years has it been extensively tested. So these days, the deviation between Newton and Einstein has been tested at the kind of parts per thousand level. Various alternative theories have been cast aside, and at this point, Einstein's general theory of relativity is the standard theory for how gravity would work. But we know it's wrong, because there isn't a way to make it amenable to quantum mechanics. So something has to be wrong with the general theory. Einstein actually knew that pretty early on and worked on it for most of his life. Lots of other people have worked on it. The problem of quantum gravity, still an unsolved problem. But if we believe general theory, then what happens in a black hole is all of the mass is concentrated into a single mathematical point, a singularity. And I repeat, that really can't be correct, but presumably something pretty close to that has to be correct. And nothing can move fast enough, since you can't move faster than the speed of light. Nothing can escape from inside a distance that's called the Schwarzschild radius. So there's nothing physically there. All the matter has been concentrated right to the origin, but there's a mathematical boundary between the rest of the universe and the inside of that black hole, which Schwarzschild calculated actually while World War I was going on. He was an artillery officer for the Germans. So we don't know how quantum mechanics works for gravity, but there's kind of some hints about how it would work, which is called semi-classical theory. And in the 60s, I think, Hawking, maybe it was in the 70s, Hawking calculated that in fact some black body radiation, some light that corresponds to a very low temperature, could escape the Schwarzschild radius. That's mostly irrelevant in terms of observing it, because the light that's being produced by black holes would be so long a wavelength and so little of it, because there's so little surface area, that it wouldn't be really possible to observe it. But it has all sorts of interesting consequences. So to observe black holes, we can't see anything coming from the surface in spite of the Hawking radiation. So the best bet is to have something that's going down the hole. So if there's a neighboring giant star, it will be growing to ever larger size, and some of its material will start to form an accretion disk in the vicinity of the black hole. And before it actually goes down the hole, it will reach very high temperatures, and those high temperatures will produce X-ray light. So we have the phenomena of X-ray binaries. Since it's a binary star system, we have the potential to actually measure the masses involved. And as long as the mass of the thing that we don't see is more than about 3 times the mass of the sun, that's the biggest possible mass for a neutron star, we know it has to be a black hole. That is to say, we haven't figured out anything that could be compact more than 3 times the mass of the sun. So we see such a situation in Cygnus X1. It's an X-ray source. We see a massive blue star that's being pushed around by something, which we don't see. And we can kind of calculate the mass. Remember that to actually accurately calculate the mass, it needs to be an eclipsing binary system. And this isn't an eclipsing binary system, so there's only kind of a statistical calculation of what the mass of the unseen thing is. But it sure seems it's highly likely that it's more than 10 times the mass of the Sun. So it's highly likely that Cygnus X1 contains a black hole that's a result of a supernova millennia in the past. So we'll talk a lot more about giant black holes that are at the center of galaxies in a couple of weeks or so. So there we have even better data about what's going on. But these solar-sized black holes, since they're not producing much light, about the only chance to observe them is in binaries, and then the only way to get a mass is in eclipsing binaries, and we don't have an example of that yet. So there isn't a foolproof example of a black hole, but the evidence is really good for the existence of black holes. So mass transfer, here it was producing X-rays. If we have mass transfer onto a white dwarf, we get unprocessed material, hydrogen, which can explode, on a degenerate star, a white dwarf, and if it heats up hot enough, it'll burn on the surface. And these novas are exactly that sort of case, and they repeat. So once we burned off the stuff from the surface of the star, and probably most of it escapes the surface of the star, there's probably a little bit of net mass addition to the white dwarf, but mostly the stuff is burned off, and more stuff will come, and decades, centuries later, there'll be a repeat explosion at the same location. So we see stuff that's being dumped onto white dwarfs, and Chandrasekhar tells us that white dwarfs can't be more massive than 1.4 times the mass of the Sun. So it's pretty clear that occasionally it'll happen that they exceed that mass limit. And people speculate that that's what's behind the type 1a supernovas. I would say the book is a little bit more sure about it, about that than I am. All of these things are really difficult to both calculate and observe. We see the stars explode, but we don't see what was there beforehand. And when we try and mathematically model what might be going on, they don't quite work. But I certainly believe that type 1As have to do with white dwarfs that are going over the Chandrasekhar mass limit, but exactly how that occurs, I'm less sure than the book is. Type 2s, I'm reasonably sure that those have to do with the death of massive stars, but the details people are still working on. So there have really been two Nobel Prizes on this sort of stuff, but it's still not perfectly clear, at least to me. More Nobel Prizes to be won. Yeah, I think that's probably true. Questions? Okay, so chapter 19 deals with our galaxy. Well, maybe I'll flash this transparency first just to kind of remind you this important recycling that is always happening. So in grade school, you learned about things like the carbon cycle, where since on Earth, carbon doesn't become anything else. It can become part of sugar, it can become part of coal, become part of a dinosaur, but the carbon atoms aren't fundamentally changed. In stars, we have things fundamentally changing. Hydrogen is becoming carbon, which it doesn't happen on Earth. So we start out, and we'll talk about this in the last few weeks of class, we start out in the Big Bang with just hydrogen and helium, pretty much, at extremely high temperatures. And of course, it's pretty concentrated at that spot, but the temperatures are so high that we don't get star formation at that point. So remember that in order to get collapse, we need low temperatures and high densities. So here we have high temperatures and high densities, and the situations aren't quite right to get star formation. So we start to get cool enough temperatures that we can start to get star formation, and we see stars forming, within 500 million years of the Big Bang. But the peak of star formation probably isn't until a couple billion years after the Big Bang, when things have cooled off a little bit. So these first generations of stars are going to be a little bit different from stars that we have today, because they won't have any of the else in them, the stuff that the astronomers call the metals. They'll just have hydrogen and helium. And they will have formed in denser than average, hotter than average conditions. And our best guess is that these stars were probably more massive than stars that are forming today. But when they die, and die quickly because we think they're going to be pretty massive, they're going to contribute some of this pollution to the gas that's in the universe. So this first generation of stars, usually called population 3 stars, they're going to do the first little bit of pollution. We're going to have slightly polluted stars, population 2 stars, which have maybe 0.1% of the else. So there won't be enough silicon, for example, to make planets. So at this point, we just have hydrogen and helium planets. But these guys are going to live and die, and we're going to start to get more processed material. So the upshot is that the concentration of stuff in the universe is gradually evolving. It's gradually being polluted by stuff that's not hydrogen and helium. But unlike the carbon cycle on Earth, stuff is being forever sequestered, right? So we do get the production of white dwarfs and planets and black holes. That stuff's never going to be recycled into stars. So there is actually less and less gas available for making stars with time. And the star formation rate currently is probably only a few percent of what it was at its peak. So in the end, we'll use up all the available gas and we'll stop star formation. So all of the blue stars, which don't live very long, will be gone. And all we'll have is those very long-lived, low-mass stars. And if we wait long enough, those guys will burn through all of their hydrogen and helium, too. So the future of the universe looks bleak in terms of what's out there. Okay, so on to the galaxy. So you all know about the Milky Way, that band of light in the sky. So this is, it really doesn't look hugely impressive, at least to me. But if you put together all of the pictures, what we find is this kind of big band of light in the sky. So Southern Cross, this is the southern constellation, Alpha Centauri, kind of our nearest neighboring star. I am told that the galactic center looks pretty impressive from the southern hemisphere. So for us, it's in the constellation Sagittarius. So it's always really close to the horizon at best, or below the horizon. So we don't really get a particularly good look at the center of our galaxy. So here's Altair, Northern Cross, Deneb. So all of this stuff is associated with the plane of our galaxy. And here, presumably, we have some blocking dust that's keeping us from seeing all of the stars that are there. So the Milky Way goes 360 degrees around. And as far as we can tell, it's relatively thin. So we're pretty sure that what we have for our galaxy is a disk galaxy. And we're kind of halfway out in that disk. So when we look towards the center, the Milky Way is a little bit thicker than when we look 180 degrees away from it, but it's still plenty thick in all directions. And this is a great exaggeration to how thin our galaxy is. So our galaxy is more like a CD than it is a Frisbee. It's quite thin compared to its size. If we look at, since we live in our galaxy, it's kind of hard to see what it would look like from the outside. But if we look at other galaxies, we see some that seem to kind of match what we think ours would look like. And we think our galaxy is a spiral galaxy. That is to say that it is, of course, a disk. And in that disk, there would be concentrations of stars that make kind of a spiral pattern. It's controversial how many of these arms there are in our galaxy. I kind of vote for 4, which is kind of what this picture shows. Other people vote for 2. And the sun is not exactly in an arm, and it's kind of pretty much like this diagram is showing. A little bit on the inside of the arm that's associated with the stuff that's going on in Orion. And again, because we can't see very far, and we can't see very far because of the dust, it's really hard to kind of put together this arm. So you can see here, and we don't know what exactly happens to this arm. Here's an arm that we kind of don't know which way it's going. And what's going on the far side, we really have no idea at all. Okay, so we can't see that, right? So we're mostly looking at other galaxies and saying, this seems to match what ours is. If we try and map things like the open clusters, the associations of O and B stars, which don't live very long, we can kind of make out regions where there are lots of new stars being formed and regions that seem to be a lot darker. So it's believable to put together the picture that we've got for our galaxy. It turns out with radio light, we can do a lot better than with visible light. So in terms of kind of basic size and structure, in round numbers, the diameter of our disk seems to be about 100,000 light years. There are lots of galaxies that are bigger than that, smaller than that. Andromeda, which is our neighboring spiral galaxy, seems to be a little bit bigger than that. M101, where I looked at that supernova, seems to be 20% bigger than that. So it's not hugely different from a lot of other sorts of galaxies. Our location, as I say, roughly halfway out. Our book says 27,000 light years. And I don't know, some other people might say 25,000 light years, but that sort of number. Incidentally, the number that probably would change the most with different people is the diameter of the disk. So the disk doesn't have a definite end, right? It just fades away. So there isn't like there's an edge of the galaxy. And lots of people would say that the diameter of our galaxy is 150,000 light years, just going a little bit further out into the edge. And what is certainly true is that the region surrounding our galaxy, sometimes called the halo, is a lot bigger than the galaxy itself. Okay, so this is a great underestimate in the size of this halo region that's surrounding the main disk. So the central area is called the nucleus, and it has kind of a bulge outward, that is to say it's fatter than the disk of the galaxy. The sun is, of course, in the plane of the galaxy. The thickness of the galaxy is roughly about 1,000 light years or so. And again, it doesn't have a definite boundary. It just kind of thins out as we go above or below the disk. So the diagram is showing us where certain objects are. So you remember, we learned about globular clusters. Those are old, extremely dense collections of stars, maybe 1 million stars or 100,000 stars in 50 light year or so radius. Those guys seem to be higgly piggly around our galaxy. So in terms of actual data as opposed to kind of a diagram, here's a diagram of the location of the globular clusters, where the plane of the galaxy would be kind of like this. And the center of our galaxy would be kind of like this. So the globular clusters can be way above the plane of the galaxy, way below the plane of the galaxy. They seem to be concentrated kind of spherically around the center of our galaxy. So that's in contrast to the open clusters, right? Those are the other things that we talked about in terms of things we could but didn't observe out at the observatory. So here are the location of open clusters, and you can see they're very much concentrated in the plane of the galaxy. So open clusters are where new stars are being formed, or formed recently. So star formation is going on in the plane of the galaxy, and these old globular clusters, star formation, they're ended billions of years ago, maybe 10 billion years ago. New star formation is going on where the gas and the dust is, which is in the plane. Globular clusters are showing where the gas in the disk was 10 billion years ago, not where it is today. Okay, so if we look at types of stars, so remember population 1 stars, those are stars like the Sun that have a little bit of pollution in them. Look at population 2 stars. We see that the population 1 stars are pretty much confined to the plane of our galaxy, whereas the population 2 stars, like the globular clusters, often rise way above the plane. And again, this is suggesting that the history of formation of our galaxy starts with something that's more spherical, and the first level of star formation, we have kind of spherically distributed stars, and then the gas and the dust coagulated into this plane, and that's where we get star formation today. And of course, the gas and the dust have been polluted by all of the star formation that's gone on in the past. Okay, so here's kind of another picture that is supposed to show us the same sort of thing in a kind of quasi-color way. So new stars that are forming, those are the only ones that can be blue, right? The hot blue stars don't live very long, so any type B star that you see had to be formed in the last 10 million years or so. So the blue stars are confined to the arms, where presumably they form in these open clusters that we've described before. The nucleus has a lot of these older stars in it, and the older stars are going to be red giants or dwarfed main sequence stars, and so they're going to have kind of a reddish look compared to the rest of it. Right? So you can see in this diagram they're claiming that the Sun is 30,000 light years away. There's actually a pretty good recent measurement of that distance. So it's things in astronomy are often pretty uncertain, but like the diameter of the disk of the galaxy, because there isn't kind of an edge, but there is a definite distance between the Sun and the center of our galaxy. And maybe I should comment that the galaxy does have a definite center. As we'll learn, it has a massive black hole in the center that really defines the exact center of the galaxy. And by watching how that center of our galaxy seems to move because the Sun is in orbit around it, that's how we can get pretty good distances, certainly more accurate than, probably accurate to about 5% for the distance between the Sun and the outer parts of the inner parts of the galaxy. So again, to kind of set the scale, because of this dust, which is itself concentrated in the plane of the galaxy, kind of what we can conveniently see with an optical telescope is about that sort of scale. We just can't see very far in the plane of our galaxy. We can see these globular clusters just fine, even though they're much more distant, because we're not looking through the dust in order to see them. Anything we're looking at in the plane of our galaxy, it's like looking through a cloud, through a bunch of fog. We simply can't see very far with visible light. So radio light is a much better indicator for what's going on in our galaxy. So how do we get a reasonably good inventory of what's in our galaxy? So you might remember for the solar system, where the mass is all concentrated in, all is an overstatement, where 99% of the mass is concentrated in the sun, the actual velocity of the planets decreases as you go out from the sun, right? So Mercury has the most miles per hour, Pluto has the slowest miles per hour. And by Kepler's third law, if we know the orbital speed and we know the distance from the center, we can calculate the mass that's inside of it. So if we start to do that with our galaxy, look at how fast the stars are going around, and incidentally, the scale here for the orbits is on the order of 100 million years for how long it takes the Earth to make one orbit around the galaxy. If we look at the velocities, this blue line is hypothetical. If we look at the velocities, there isn't a big sign of a decrease in velocity with distance. So what that means is if we calculate the amount of mass that's we calculate the amount of mass that's inside this circle. As we increase the size of these circles, there's more and more mass inside of it. And in fact, there's really no sign of decline. As I say, the blue line there is what we would expect. The red line is what we actually see. So every bigger circle we make encloses more mass than the circle at the interior to it. So this is kind of a sign again that there's no edge to the galaxy. If we take a bigger piece of the pie, it weighs more than the previous piece of the pie. On the other hand, the number of stars are definitely getting rarer as we go out from the center of the galaxy. So the only conclusion is that there has to be a lot of mass that's not in the form of stars. That's going to be particularly true at the outer edge where the stars become rare, but overall, it looks like there's more mass that's not in the form of stars than there's mass that's in the form of stars. So phrasing it that way might suggest that the mass is in the form of dust or gas or something like that, but we can pretty well count up the gas and dust using the methods we talked about before, right? We can use the 21 centimeter line, the spin flip line to measure the atomic hydrogen. We can use the rotation of CO to measure the molecular hydrogen. We can measure the X-ray emission from the hot vacuum. We got a pretty good handle on the gas that's in the galaxy. And the gas and dust in the galaxy is a small fraction of the mass that's in stars. So apparently, most of the galaxy is not anything normal. So this is called the dark matter problem. Vera Rubin, who's I think currently at the University of Minnesota, was one of the perplexed discoverers of this phenomena. And I don't know, for a while people were thinking that maybe there was a new form of gravity, so that our calculations based on Kepler's third law were somehow being thrown off. But there's good evidence that, in fact, most of the mass of the galaxy is dark. Maybe 10 times, maybe 90% of the mass of our galaxy is not in the form of stars or gas or presumably anything that's on the periodic table. And so this stuff is called dark matter. And we don't know what it is, right? So it's hard to say a whole lot about it. It is stuff that has to have mass because we see the effect of gravity. And it's not in the form of stars. So there are other things it might be in the form of, right? It might be in the form of bricks. Bricks, for example, are hard to see. But people have gone through the list of pretty every imaginable stuff. People have gone through pretty much all the imaginable stuff that it could be, and they don't come up with any good possibilities. So, what I think what most people think, is that there has to be a new type of material that isn't on our periodic table. And it's probably common, because most of the mass of the galaxy is in this form. Now, admittedly, when you get close to the center, and we're halfway to the center, probably, literally, most of the stuff is stuff on the periodic table. But good fractions of it should not be on the periodic table most anywhere, and in particular, here on Earth. So you remember things like the neutrinos. There are zillions of neutrinos going through your body every second. But turns out neutrinos have a really small mass. So this new stable material is not neutrinos. Or at least it's not any neutrino that we know about. It's pretty much got to be electrically neutral. Because if it had an electric charge, if it was streaming through the Earth, it would be easily detectable. People, I mean, we just don't know a lot about it, but my belief, and I think most people's belief, is that it's probably in the form of particles that are uncharged and more massive than a proton. And people are diligently trying to detect it. So there's a project in the Sudan mine, for example, one of many. There are probably a dozen major projects going on right now to try and detect this stuff, as presumably it goes through the Earth all the time, but not leaving much of a mark. No noticeable mark that has been detected yet. And almost certainly, there's a Nobel Prize for whoever can figure out exactly what's going on there. Because for the first time, we'll understand what most of the galaxy is if we figured out what this dark matter is. Okay, so hard to say much about it except that it's plentiful. It's pretty much got to be electrically neutral. And it's certainly nothing that we know about currently. Neutrinos, even though they are plentiful and don't leave much of a mark, they leave enough of a mark that we've detected them for 50 years. And we know how many of those there are around. So the name dark matter is very similar to the name dark energy that we'll be talking about in the last weeks of this class. So mostly here I'm just drawing a distinction. So what I've said is that most of the mass in the universe is not stuff that's on the periodic table. Probably 10 times as much of stuff that's on the periodic table is dark matter. But probably 3 times as much as the dark matter, there's something else, which is even more mysterious, which is called the dark energy. And once again, the dark energy shows itself by its gravitational effects, not by any other sort of direct method. And we see the effects of dark energy not when we look at individual galaxies, but when we look at the universe as a whole. So that's why it waits for the the last bit. So the upshot is there's kind of been a repetition of diminishing of human standing, right? So in the beginning, people made the logical conclusion that the Earth was at rest because it doesn't seem to move. And, you know, look around, there are points of light. Seems like we're the most important thing around. And then we realize that the Earth is just one of many planets going around the Sun, and the Sun is one of many planets going around the galaxy, and that there are literally billions of other galaxies in the universe. And then we realize that most of the universe is not even made of stuff like us. And in fact, most of the universe isn't even made of that stuff either. It's all just made out of something else. Incidentally, I might call it the cosmological constant. That's actually what I think it is, which is actually something that Einstein invented back when he did his general theory of relativity. But its precise nature is really up for grabs. Okay, so that's what our galaxy is like. And I said that really the idea of what our galaxy is based on looking at other galaxies and seeing which one kind of makes the most sense. So Hubble, working on the big telescopes on the West Coast, Wilson and Palomar, was kind of the first guy to make an inventory of all the different ways we could have galaxies. And he made this tuning fork diagram, which is, I don't know, like the HR diagram, maybe more a source of confusion than anything else. But I think it's a good way to start to thinking about types of galaxies. So first of all, it turns out there are two types of spiral galaxies. There are galaxies that have a central bar, and there are galaxies which lack that sort of bar. So I'm not sure if you noticed the picture. So this is kind of a recent enough discovery that I have versions from textbooks in the past and currently acceptable versions. So this is a version of, what did I do with our galaxy picture? This is a version of a picture of our galaxy without a central bar, right? It looks like the nucleus is spherically symmetric. And the first picture I showed you, which I don't find. Okay, I really want that picture. Oh, here it is. Here's a picture which we think is probably more accurate these days, where the central nucleus is not spherical, it's elongated. More kind of like a football or a peanut. Actually, a peanut is what they usually say. In that central bar. So our galaxy seems to be a barred spiral galaxy. And about half of the spirals are barred and about half of them aren't barred, so the galaxy isn't unusual in that regard. So the other difference we see among spiral galaxies is how tightly the arms are wound. So we see galaxies in which there's a whole lot of nothing between the spiral arms, and there are galaxies where the spiral arms are very tightly wound together. And I don't know, if you look at, again, so this would be an example of a galaxy where the arms are very tightly wound together. And this is, as I've said, a more modern view of what our galaxy looks like, kind of in between the two extremes. So in terms of the type of galaxy, we'd say that our galaxy is a S for spiral, capital B for barred, and then intermediate in terms of how its arms are wound around. So these are irregular galaxies. So galaxies that don't have any particular shape at all. And these guys are elliptical galaxies, which are kind of like footballs. Except actually it turns out that a lot of them don't have any axis of symmetry. So they would have like a football that's been squashed in one direction. So no two axes have exactly the same amount. Okay, so among all galaxies, our galaxy is not particularly unusual, but its particular classification would be S capital B sub B. Let's talk a little bit about these ellipticals. The ellipticals are kind of like giant globular clusters in the sense that they seem to have not much gas in them and they seem to only have old stars in them. We see them in the sky in various shapes. That is to say, they might look like circles in the sky, or they might look elongated as having an eccentricity of 0.7. But a lot of that just has to do with how we're seeing the galaxy. So if we see the galaxy like that, it's going to look more or less like a circle. And if we see the galaxy like that, we're going to see it as something that's elongated. And it looks like there isn't a shape. That is to say, there really are galaxies. So if we do the statistics, right? If we had if all galaxies had a particular shape, then we can do the statistics on how they could be arranged in space, and match that to the statistics that we see. And it turns out that we think that there are actually spherical galaxies and there are actually elongated galaxies. And about half of the variation we see is due to just orientation, and about half of it is due to actually different shapes of the galaxies. So the elliptical galaxies are galaxies that have old stars in them, have this sort of football-shaped shape. Some of them may appear to be circular and aren't, and some of them probably are actually look spherical and are spherical. And the other classification here we have on the far side is galaxies that are have no particular shape.
Are the elliptical galaxies going to become spiral galaxies eventually? Is that what the diagram is showing? Is this progression?
Yeah, so Hubble, of course, was just looking at the sky. So he kind of puts together these pictures just based on, I see one that's like this, I see one that's a little bit different. So let's just put together the differences that we see as being continuous. He did think that this had something to do with the evolution of galaxies, but it has nothing to do with the evolution of galaxies. So it's just a classification scheme for how they look in the sky. So yeah, I think I'll quit there. But yeah, I do want to say that galaxies do change, but just not in any obvious way.
Right.